If you don't make that up, undoubtedly there will be some test questions that you might miss because of that. So, okay, good. Now, where did we leave off? I lost my marker here in Revelation chapter 13. I'll bet the devil stole it right out of my notebook. I'll bet you that's what happened. What is it? Chapter 13 and verse 10? Okay, good. So I didn't... Luke 21:19. Good, okay. So we didn't start with chapter 13, verse 11. Well, let's start there today. Here in Revelation chapter 13 and verse 11... I knew it was somewhere in that general area, chapter 13 and verse 11. Sometimes I get a little bit mixed up because I have an evening class too, Apocalypse Daniel. And it's really funny because you're teaching them both and you can't remember what you said where. So if sometimes I say the same thing over again, well, I can't remember if I said it. You just forget sometimes. Well, chapter 13, verse 11. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. Well, we mentioned at the outset that this chapter centers around two personalities. And the first one is a description of the beast with a mouth, which is the Antichrist and his world government. Now we're starting to look at another beast that comes up out of the earth. And it's a different beast than the one that we saw up in verse 1. But I do believe that they're going to rise up at the same time. And the reason why is that it's this second beast who's going to cause the world to worship the first beast. And he's going to cause the world to give themselves to the first beast. Obviously, they're working hand in hand. They're at the same time. But in the vision, often the vision is sequential. That is, there's a certain aspect that follows another aspect because you can't relate the two at the same time. Now, this beast is coming up from the earth. That would symbolize the religious system. We talked about that a little bit earlier in our study. He's coming from the religious system of the world. So the first beast, then, is the Antichrist and his world government. The second beast is what is called the false prophet, who undoubtedly is going to be the head of the world church. Now, the Bible calls him the false prophet. This is not a title that we've assigned him. The Bible himself gives him that title. He's called that in chapter 16. And verse 13, he's also called the false prophet in chapter 19 and verse 20, and also chapter 20 and verse 10. Now, why does the Bible call him a false prophet? Well, look at verse 11. It says that he has got two horns, now notice, like a lamb, but, and that word but, or and he spake as a dragon. You could say but he spake as a dragon as well. So he's got two horns like a lamb, but he speaks like a dragon. So in other words, he has the gentleness of a lamb, but it's combined with the cunning and the ferocity of the devil himself. And so he's a fitting picture of the leader of the world church. Now, we know in the Bible that horns are a picture of power. And this time we see two horns here, which would represent undoubtedly two arms or two spheres of power. He doesn't just have one horn, he's got two of them. And of course, the first question that comes to our mind is, what are the two spheres of power that this false prophet is going to exercise control over? Well, I'm not totally certain about this. I know what one horn is, but the other horn, I'm not quite as certain. One horn is undoubtedly religious power. He's going to be the religious leader of the Antichrist's system. And we know that the devil has got a big world harlot that he's building. It's a mystery Babylon. It's a harlot religious system. And undoubtedly, he's going to be in charge of that. Now, the second horn could be, I believe, one of two things. It could be either political power. And you say, well, how does that relate to religious power? Very simple. If you look at some of the major religions of the world, for example, Catholicism and the World Council of the Churches, they wield tremendous political power. They have great political clout, and it's even greater when it's going to be united with the other religions of the world to form like one world church. So it could be political power, but the second thought is that it could be economic power Or maybe really it's both of them. I don't know. But the other possibility would be economic power. And again, just one typical example, the Catholic Church, which undoubtedly is going to form the core of the future world church. You don't think it's just going to disappear from the earth, do you? It's been here for over 1,500 years. It's not going to just disappear. And so the Catholic Church has got incredible, fantastic wealth, like you cannot imagine. And later on, when we get to chapter 18, we're going to see, I'm going to read you some statistics about the Catholic Church as far as their real estate assets and their financial holdings and everything and various things that they have done. It just boggles the mind how much money they really have. It's just totally incredible, especially in light of the fact of how many of their communicants and their people live in some of the poorer third world countries. Now, these two horns, notice carefully in your Bible, are like a lamb. And the Bible makes it clear now, when you read the authorities and what they have to say here, that it's not the beast that is like a lamb, but rather the horns are like a lamb. These are lamb-like horns. So the horns are just like a lamb. So the phrase like a lamb connects grammatically to horns and not the beast. In other words, it's not trying to say, well, this is a beast that looked like a lamb. Rather, what it's trying to say is that this beast has got two horns, and these two horns are lamb-like in nature. Not that they look like a lamb, but it's just simply trying to tell you they are lamb-like. Not that they necessarily look like a lamb, but they are lamb-like. That's what I'm trying to say here. And what that would indicate is power exercised in a lamb-like way. He's going to wield great power. But how is it going to be wielded? It's going to be wielded like a lamb. In other words, with apparent gentleness and with soft speeches and concerning love and concerning unity and concerning the brotherhood of man and concerning concern for the poor. And you see, that's how the liberals come on as well. They speak like a lamb. And yet he's going to use the power available to him to crush everyone that opposes him. Just like the Catholic Church did down through history. If you read the history of the Catholic Church and the Inquisition, the popes and the cardinals, they spoke like a lamb. And they would come out and they would bless the people and they would speak in pious tones, but you dare oppose them during that time, and they'd place you on the rack and tear you to pieces. It's like one pope said at one time, the church will use all means at her disposal to bring her wayward sons back to the faith. Well, that's exactly what they did. And they had power, it was horn-like power, but it was exercised in a lamb-like way. And Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 15, the Savior said, beware of false prophets which come unto you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravening wolves. And then Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 14, in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 14, he said this, and no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. And so they come on and they have all the charisma, the soft tone. They use the terms love and brotherhood and everything. But it's a real powerful type thing behind that lamb-like facade. You know, those with great power can say powerful things without raising their voice when they've got great power like that. Now, the Bible says that he's going to speak as a dragon. He's going to speak as a dragon. In other words, the false prophet is going to deceive men by acting like a lamb, but really he's going to speak the words of Satan himself. And that's why it is so vital to not just see how people say things, but to listen carefully to what they are saying. And this is where oftentimes man is tricked up, because he'll listen to how it's being said. And people listen to the Pope, and if you watch the Pope, he has a pious demeanor about him. There's a reverence, there's a holiness about him, as far as his outward demeanor is concerned. He's soft, he looks like he's benevolent, he looks like he's the type of guy that would harm no one on the face of the earth. And there is that lamb-like facade. Now, Lenin said to his Bolsheviks, and, of course, they were the founders of the communist country of USSR. Here's what Lenin said, quote, we will find our most fertile field for infiltration of Marxism within the field of religion, because religious people are the most gullible and will accept almost anything if it is couched in religious terminology, end quote. Oh, that's so true. If you just have, throw a couple religious words into what you're saying and add a couple phrases, add God, add Jesus too. Make sure you add Jesus. Everyone knows that Jesus was a good man. And so add those terms, and people will all of a sudden accept what you have to say, even though you're saying all kinds of things that are off base from the Bible. And in fact, you can even look at what is a real thorn in the side of the Vatican today, liberation theology. And there are many many priests down in Latin America and South America which are diehard communists, which are couching communism in the terms of Catholicism. Well, then I want to read chapter 13 and verse 12. In a few minutes here, we'll take some time for questions here. But chapter 13, verse 12, so I'm not ignoring you if you have a question. But chapter 13, verse 12, and he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. Now, when the Bible says he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, the phrase before him does not mean before him in time. It means before him in the sense of in sight of him or under him. So in other words, he's going to exercise the power of the first beast, but in sight of the first beast. In other words, as his assistant, working hand in hand, as colleagues, as associates, everything that he does, he's giving his orders directly from the first beast. And he's working just hand in hand with him. Everything that he does is going to be tied in with the Antichrist. He's going to be a supporting character to the Antichrist. He's going to be active on behalf of him. He's going to exercise his authority. He's going to speak in behalf of the Antichrist to support him in every single way he can. And his whole purpose is going to be one thing, to work towards complete dominance of the earth by the Antichrist under the guise of religion. Under the guise of religion. And you know, the devil has always merged political and religious power together. He knows that men are innately religious. And you can't just tell people, don't be religious any longer. They're going to be religious whether you want them to or not. So you've got to find a way to weld the two powers together, political power and religious power. Let me give you some examples from the Bible. Remember a man called Pharaoh down in Egypt? And Pharaoh, of course, was actually over the Israelites at that time. He had them in bondage to him. And when Moses arrived on the scene and when Moses did all those incredible miracles, remember what Pharaoh did? Pharaoh summoned his magicians, and they were competing with the miracles of Moses and Aaron, and they duplicated a number of them. And there was religious power. The magicians welded together with the political power of the Pharaoh. Or how about Balak, king of Moab? And here's Balak, this politician, as it were, and he wanted to destroy the Israelites. So what did he do? He hired Balaam, a prophet of God. And he worked through the religion as well as the political power to destroy the Israelites. And how about when Absalom rebelled against David? And what happened there? Well, there was a man called Ahithophel. And Absalom recruited the services of Ahithophel, who was actually a counselor of David. And Absalom used this man as an advisor to aid his treason. And again, you see, you have the idea of religious power welded together with political power. How about Jeroboam, classical example, the first king over northern Israel, and what did he do to consolidate his empire once he obtained the kingship? He set up the golden calves at Dan and Bethel because he wanted to get the people's religious affections aligned with his own kingdom. And how about wicked King Ahab? Where did he receive his guidance in guiding the affairs of northern Israel? From wicked Jezebel. Who was she? The daughter of Ethbaal from up there in Phoenicia, which was the epitome, I should say, of paganism and diabolical worship, so on and so forth. Well, then it goes on to say in verse 12, and he causes the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast. Fantastic deception. Here is this, quote, great Christian leader, end quote, leading the world to worship the beast, which in turn leads to the lake of fire, which tells you what type of religious leader he really is. He's a spiritual harlot. That's what he is. And his church is living in spiritual fornication with the world government. His main purpose is to drive men to worship the world system that's been revived from the death stroke and to worship the Antichrist at the head of that world system. And they're both aligned together. And that's his whole calling, that's his whole goal, is to get men to worship the devil, to get men to worship the world system. And you say, well, I don't see how man would ever worship man. Oh, it's not so hard to understand if you look at some things that are happening even now and have happened for a long time. Again, and it seems like I'm really throwing some punches at the Catholics, and I'm not. But if you stop and consider the Pope is worshipped right now by many. Let me read a quote to you from J.A. Sice, page 339. He says it like no one else can. He says, quote, "Nay, at this very hour there resides a man in the city of Rome, whom one half of Christendom itself hails, honors, and adores as the vicar of Jesus Christ, the vice-regent of God upon earth, infallible and sole possessor of the keys of heaven, a man whom the greater festivals exhibit as a divinity, borne along in solemn procession on the shoulders of a consecrated priest, while sacred incense fumes before him in blessed peacock's feathers full of eyes wave beside his moving throne. And every mortal on the street where he passes uncovers, kneels, and silently adores him. A man who once a year takes his seat upon the high altar of the sublimest church in Christendom in the broad light of this favored century and there receives the adoration of the whole college of his most exalted subjects who reverently bow amid chants, music, and burning lights to kiss the toe of his holiness." End quote. That's what they do. The cardinals, they'll kiss his toe. Yeah. They'll kiss his toe. Danny O'Brien said once, "I'd bite it," but he was thinking about being a Catholic priest at one time, and so he, you know, appreciates his removal from Catholicism. Now, there's another lengthy article that I have, and I won't read it to you unless I have enough time to read it to you, but it's the account that the pastor alluded to last night at service. He's talked about it many times, about this Muslim holy man called Abdul Baraha Baha of Syria who was living there in the 1940s, and this account with Dr. Hollenbeck. And that account is really fascinating because when you read it, Dr. Hollenbeck, he was not a fanatical Christian or anything like that. He was a man that had a spiritual equilibrium about him, and he actually obtained audience with this man from Syria, and he states right in there, after this man did marvelous miracles, including raising a person from the dead right in his sight and calling fire down from heaven and doing a number of other things, he said it just took everything within him from not worshiping this man. And there was an aura about his countenance, and he said there were times when he was a man of fierce countenance. He spent several days with this individual, and his whole countenance would change. And he said, that's the man that the book of Daniel is talking about, the man with a fierce countenance. And then other times his whole complexion would change, and he was like an angel from God, see. And so I won't take the time to read that to you, but right now anyway, but maybe we'll have time later on. I want to read verse 13 to you, Revelation chapter 13 and verse 13, about the false prophet, "And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men." Now, I want to say something about the word wonders. It's the Greek word semion, spelled like this in the transliteration. Obviously, he's not going to just be able to appear on the religious scene and just simply say, "Worship the Antichrist," and all the world will do that. He's got to do something more than that. And this is what the Bible talks about in this verse. He does semions, S-long-E-M-E-I-O-N. Now, this is the same word that's used by John in his Gospels to describe the ministry of Jesus. Jesus did many signs. Jesus did many wonders. This is talking about a sign of divine power, as it were. Of course, now it's not divine power. It's demonic power. He's doing signs of demonic power. Thayer says it means a sign or a prodigy or a portent. A portent is something that points to something else, see? It's an unusual event, Thayer says, transcending the common course of nature, end quote. So he's going to do outright miracles that transcend the laws of nature. The word is used 7 times in the book of Revelation. 3 times it is used to refer to special revelations from God. For example, it's used in chapter 12 and verse 1. In a positive way now. It's used that way in chapter 12 and verse 3 and chapter 15 and verse 1. All those references use semion to refer to a special revelation from God. However, it is used 4 times to refer to the deceptions imposed by Satan himself on the world. For example, it's used that way in this verse, and then in verse 14, the verse that follows, and then in chapter 16 and verse 14, and then finally in chapter 19 and verse 20. Now, when you study the Bible carefully about signs and wonders, what you'll find is this, is that miracles were signs from God, the positive ones, the good ones now, they were signs from God to confirm that the word of his messenger was actually from him. God gave signs to Jesus to authenticate his ministry. God gave signs to Elijah, to Paul, to authenticate their words and their ministry. And so what the devil is doing now, in contrast to all this, the devil, through the false prophet, is giving the false prophet signs to confirm his word. And there are going to be deceptive signs. So he's going to be equipped by the devil, by the Antichrist, with authority, with power, to do supernatural signs to, as it were, the Bible says, deceive the very elect, if it were possible. And that's found in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 24. Matthew 24, verse 24. Now what that's saying, my friend, is this, that if you were to see these signs and listen to him speak, and you're the elect, you would be very, very, very strongly tempted to believe it. And that's talking about you now. And so therefore, when the unbeliever sees it now, that's not born again, he does not have a newborn spirit, and he doesn't know God, he is going to accept it. He is going to believe it. He will be deceived by it. Now it says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 9, listen to it now, about the Antichrist. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 9, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan, and we saw that's the energizing, the inworking of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders. So many of these are not going to be real miracles, they are lying wonders. Optical illusions, or there's all kinds of things they can do with technology now. They've got fiber optics and holograms and all this type of thing, where they can make images in the atmosphere and in the sky, and they can do all kinds of incredible things. We don't know what the devil is going to do as far as technology. And these are going to be lying wonders. And 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 13 as well. 2 Timothy chapter 3 verse 13 as well. And that's why it's going to be very important for the Laodiceans to keep close with God. And like Jesus said, to buy of themselves eye salve that thou mayest see, so that they won't be deceived by him. Now, one typical sign that he's going to do, that the Bible enumerates, and he's going to do many more than just this one. Fire from heaven is called down. Fire from heaven. And he may do this by demonic delusion, or it may be literal fire. It may be actual fire. You see, demons apparently do have some limited power now. I don't know how much they have, but limited power to interact with the physical realm. And I don't know the extent of it, but I do know this. In Job chapter 1 and verse 16, when the devil was able to tempt and to test Job, the Bible says that the fire of God fell from heaven, and it burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, Job 1:16. Now that was not God that directly brought that. It was God that allowed it. It was the devil that brought it. Because God does not do that type of thing to his servants. God doesn't bring fire from heaven to consume Job or anything like that. God will allow or use the devil to do that. But you see, the devil apparently was able to cause that thing to happen. And then again, in Exodus chapter 7, verses 11 through 12, in Exodus chapter 8 and verse 7. In that passage there, as well as 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 8, it talks about Jannes and Jambres. And they were the magicians down in Egypt. And here was Moses down there, and he was turning a rod into a serpent and back again. What were they doing? The same thing. He was taking water and pouring it out, and the water was turned into blood. What did they do? The same thing. And there were, as it were, dust that was changed into lice. What did they do? I think they did the same thing with that miracle as well. And the frogs, when Moses called frogs out of the water, what did they do? They did the same thing. And what were they now? Were they demonic delusions or were they actual frogs? I don't know, but they sure looked like frogs. I mean, they looked like real miracles, real things. And so the devil is able, to a certain degree, to duplicate and to perform certain types of miracles, although a certain percentage of them might be lying wonders. And then look at the effect here in verse 14. And he's going to deceive them that dwell on the earth. Okay, now before we look at this verse, maybe there are a couple of questions that I think our brothers had here. Yes, go ahead, Mark. Okay.
One was, would the miracles and the strength of all that the Antichrist and his prophet are able to do now be so much greater because we're gone and God allows more deception to come on?
I think so. The standard of righteousness is not the same there on the earth, and people are more prone to yield to the devil, and when that happens, of course, the devil has more sway. So I think the fact that the man-child is not there and Philadelphia is not there will allow the devil to have more power. Yes.
The second question was on the two horns.
Yes.
Of the false prophets.
Yes.
One was religious power. The other was suggesting political or economic power.
Yes.
Does that conflict with the Antichrist having political power?
Oh, you mean as far as him? I don't think so, because, see, it would be political power exercised in his sight, at his beck, at his command, hand in hand with him. And it would be similar to what we have in the Vatican right now, where the Vatican has great political power as well as religious power. And, for example, you know, Reagan appointed an ambassador to go over there and to meet with the Vatican. Why? Well, there's political power. There's political implications there. Many of the nations, third world countries, are entirely Catholic. Mexico, countries like that. And you've got to deal with them often through the Catholic Church. See? And so it's political power, but it's still at the beck of the Antichrist. It's not like he forfeits some of his power. It's just kind of channeled through the religious area. Yes. And Brother George, did you have a question?
Well, probably not.
Okay.
We're talking about the earth represents the religions of the world.
Uh-huh.
In verse 12, it says, the earth and those that dwell therein, definitely talking about literal world.
Yeah, right. There are times when the Bible will use a symbol and where it'll have a double application. And so what you've got to do, you've got to look at it and see how it's used. When it talks about him arising up out of the earth, it's not talking about him coming up out of a gopher hole or a foxhole or something. It's symbolic of that, you know, in that sense. Then there are other times when the Bible just simply wants to tell you, it'll say the whole earth worships him. Now, in that sense, it's talking about the people of the earth, not the actual physical globe. So the terms are used to overlap sometimes, and you have to look at them and see how they're used. Yes, maybe two more questions before we move on.
I was reading that book, and they said that nowadays with all the complex things they have, these holographic images and so forth, that they can beam a light up with satellite and so forth, that where the light can shine upon one third of the earth, and it would look like fire.
It's interesting. That's interesting, isn't it? Candy.
In 17 verses, it talks about how the holy world will wonder after the beast.
Yes.
And it makes it sound like the thing that causes them to wonder after him is that he was and is not and will come.
Yes. Oh, you mean why to me it would be, well, I think the amazing thing is how soon it comes back. Power. I think so, yeah. I think that's going to open up the door, and they're saying, like, who is able to make war with him, and he's the greatest being on the earth, and world government, it's finally here, it's finally arrived. But see, to acknowledge it in that sense and to wonder after it is one thing, but then to worship it, where it now holds the supreme affections of your heart, is another thing. And you can wonder and really adulate someone and really appreciate them and really extol them, but then to actually make them the object of your worship, which is saying that they are God now, that's another step. And so it's like the false prophet is just leading them another step down the pathway of deception as I see it. Okay, well, let's look at verse 14. It says, that he is going to deceive them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight or before of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. Now this is where the Bible starts to get real interesting in this passage here. But not that it hasn't been up to this point in time, but there are some real significant things that are said here that are really mind-boggling. First of all, notice in verse 14 that it says miracles plural now. So we know that it's more than just calling down fire from heaven. There are many miracles that the Bible is not really telling you about. And it's also interesting that the two witnesses are doing the same type of miracles. They're calling fire down from heaven in chapter 11, and they're also doing miracles as well. So these are satanic miracles then to counter the effect of the miracles of the two witnesses of God's servants on the earth. And that's going to, as it were, dilute their ministry now, because the devil is going to say, well, if you're the true way, then why are these servants over here who are saying to worship the Antichrist, why are they doing the same miracles you're doing? And so they're going to attest that the beast is worthy to be worshipped, and many are going to be deceived. Now, the Bible goes on to say that what the false prophet is going to do, he is going to lead the world and suggest to the world that they should make an image to the beast. And they are going to actually carry this out. Now, I believe that this image could be either literal or figurative, although my personal feelings, I lean, again, more towards a literal image of the beast. Let me kind of explain a couple things about this image to you. Then we'll see whether how the literal scenario would fit and how the figurative one would fit. First of all, the Greek word for image is icon. You've heard of an icon? This is spelled like this. Actually, it would be icon. Simply I-E-I-K-long-O-N, icon. E-I-K-long-O-N. And really, it has the idea of representation. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a literal representation, although it can be that. For example, it's used in a literal way in the gospel accounts to refer to the image on the coin when the Jews were asking Jesus, do we have to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And Jesus said, take out a coin, whose superscription is on it? Whose picture? Whose image is on it? And they looked on that coin, and there was an actual physical representation, wasn't there, on that coin. And Jesus said, well, render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and so forth. It's also used of statues or idols in the Bible to talk about the Gentiles that turned from the living God and made themselves idols. They made themselves images, icons, and they worshipped them. And they were actual representations of their gods, see? But then by the same token, it's also used in a spiritual sense, for example, of describing Jesus Christ, who is said to be the image of God, and now we are being transformed into that same image, into that same icon. So what I'm saying is, the word itself does not tell you whether this is an actual physical object, a physical image that they're making like a statue, or whether it is something that is spiritual going on in their hearts. So let me suggest a literal and a figurative scenario here. The literal one would go like this. The false prophet very possibly may deceive the world to the point where he suggests to them that they actually make an idolatrous image that's going to represent the world system, that's going to represent the Antichrist himself. And by worshiping and falling down before this idol, they in turn are worshiping the Antichrist. You see, the Antichrist is going to be one person. He's limited. He's not everywhere at once. And so therefore, it is possible that there will be idols of him throughout the world. And the world will actually fall down, actually bow down before them. In fact, they might be something that you can place in your home, an image or an idol of him that you can put in your home and worship that, or maybe hang it up in your window as homage to him, or maybe it will be set up in all the towns throughout the world. And they will go and they will worship that image. Now, you say that seems incredible, but remember the devil is not through with man yet.
Amen.
And remember also that probably the majority of the world right now worships images. For example, Catholics do. They're already conditioned to this. Buddhists do. They bow down before their images, and they'll tell you that the image is not their God, but they're worshiping their God through the image. Well, that's probably what the false prophet will say, something like that as well. But the pagans of Africa and those in the Isles of the Sea and so on and so forth, many of the people in the world already worship images. So it's not really that far-fetched to have a literal image in which people would bow down before and worship, especially after they've been deceived, and especially after verse 15 starts coming to pass, as we're going to see, when the image starts speaking to them and talking to them. But number two, the figurative scenario would be like this. The image would be something spiritual. It would be like spiritual idolatry, an image that the false prophet, through deception, is able to set up, through demonic power or whatever, he's able to set this image up in their hearts. And so they're worshiping the beast in their hearts now. That's what they're worshiping, and that would be the other possibility. And so this image of Satan and the image of the Antichrist is right there in their hearts. And just like the Bible tells us, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Well, when it tells us to do that, God is not so much worried about us bowing down before a physical idol. We wouldn't do that. But there are spiritual idols and images and icons that you can set up in your heart and worship those, see? And so maybe that's what's in view here. And the false prophet would be instrumental in doing that, in setting that image or idol up in their heart. Although, again, in my personal opinion, I lean a little bit more towards the actual literal. Now, this image is referred to three times in this chapter and then mentioned seven more times in the book of Revelation. Let me give you the seven other references outside of this chapter to the image. In chapter 14 and verse 9, chapter 14 and verse 11, chapter 15 and verse 2, and chapter 16 and verse 2, and chapter 19 and verse 20, and chapter 20 and verse 4. When I read those passages there, they sure seem to me like something more than just a spiritual idol in their heart. Seems like something they were actually literally doing. And then it goes on and it says in verse 15, "And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed." Now, there are some very fascinating things about this verse. Let me unlock some of the meanings to you here. First of all, when it says, "and he had power," it's talking about the false prophet. But literally what it is saying is, it was given to him to have power to give life to the beast, or to the image of the beast. It was given to him. In other words, he did not have the power himself. Someone gave him the power to in turn give life to the image. And undoubtedly, this is the devil giving him this power. Or the Antichrist, you know, that is the devil through the Antichrist giving him the power. And he has actually been given the power by the devil to give life to this image of the beast. Now, the word life is the Greek word pneuma, which is often translated in our Bibles as spirit, like the Holy Spirit, the Holy Pneuma. And so what this is saying is that there is breath or spirit given to the image. Now, let me just say this. I don't think that the devil has the power to create. I don't think the power of creation belongs to the devil. I don't think he can do that. I don't think he can take like an actual idol and actually make it breathe and create it and give life to it. I don't think he's got that type of power. I think that type of power belongs only to God. So I think this is some type of demonic wonder or satanic illusion or wonder. That's my opinion. Now, what would this be literally? So it was given to the false prophet to give life or breath or spirit to the image, and then the image starts actually talking. That's what it starts doing. Well, if you looked at it literally, here's how it would go literally. Literally, the false prophet apparently could do demonic wonders and satanic wizardry, some type of optical illusion or whatever, and could actually cause the image of the beast to appear to come to life and speak. And now people are coming and they're bowing down before this thing, and it's speaking to them. It's talking to them. And they're actually communicating with it now. Can you imagine the type of deception that would occur on the earth if that thing happened? I mean, they would give themselves to the beast. They would give themselves to the Antichrist. So therefore, the idol goes far beyond just a stone image, just a stone block, but it actually is talking to them, actually is communicating to them, actually appears to have life, actually appears to be alive and living. And evidently, it's a demonic wonder. And, of course, people have suggested something, well, maybe a TV image. Maybe that's what this image of the beast is. Well, I'm not so certain I can rule that out. However, There's a couple things that are unlikely, I think, with a TV image. First of all, there's been thousands of images on the TV already of every monster you can imagine, and the world has not fallen down before the devil and worshipped him through those images. And I'm not so certain that anything, that something could happen on the TV that would cause that. In other words, they've seen everything from E.T. to you name it, and it hasn't caused them to literally fall down and take the mark of the beast and so forth. But also, this is something that is affecting the entire world now, in verse 14, very obviously affecting the whole world. But most of the people on earth don't have TV. Most of the people on the earth are extremely poor. The population of the earth is centered in Asia and in India and in those countries in Southeast Asia, and they're so poor they don't have TVs. And so the majority of the population would not even have a TV unless someone gave them one to even really look upon it. So I'm not so certain it would be something like a TV. But whether it would be something like a robot that the devil would create or what it would be, I don't know. But if the literal scenario is what we're looking at, they actually come and they're bowing down before it, and the false prophecy is causing this image to speak. And they're communicating with it now, and they're talking to it. And what's going to happen? They're going to receive the mark of the beast through this image. Now, how about the figurative scenario? Well, in my opinion, this is where you start straining a little bit when you try to make it all figurative. But I'll tell you what it would be if it was figurative. It would be a very real coming to life of the image in the heart of man. In other words, the false prophet would be breathing on that spiritual idol in the heart of man. He would be deceiving them, and he would be giving the people of the world religious motivation. He would be imparting to them impetus to worship that idol in their heart, and he would therefore make the idol come to life in their life, see? It's one thing to have, like, set up a spiritual idol in your heart. It's another thing to have the thing come to life where it now is controlling your life, it's speaking to you, it's controlling everything about you. And see, the false prophet, if you make it figurative, could be said to have that type of power to cause that spiritual idol to come to life. And so his power is going to be exercised in a lamb-like way, causing the idol to come to life in their heart, and they're going to worship this image in their heart. They're going to worship the devil and the Antichrist. Now, it goes on to say in verse 15 something about this image. It says that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Now, it's very clear now that the false prophet is causing the image to do two things. He's causing the image, number one, to speak, but then the false prophet is causing the image now, and the image is actually doing this. The image is causing that as many people as would not worship itself to be killed. Now, the false prophet led the image to do that, if you know what I'm saying. But it's actually the image that's involved in the killing or carrying out of the killing of those who do not worship it. So in other words, what I'm saying is that it is the image that speaks, and it is the image that causes those who don't bow down to it to be killed. And you can look at this in the Greek or the English, a lot of different translations. And I've looked at them all, the commentators, and most of the authorities say that it is the image doing both things. That it is the image that is speaking, and that it is the image that causes the killing of those who will not bow down to it. Now, what this could be if it is the literal picture is this. The actual literal image is speaking to those who worship it. And it's actually talking to them, communicating to them, if you will, by satanic power that was given to the false prophet. And then the image makes pronouncements on those who do not worship it and says, you will be killed if you do not worship me. I command that you will be killed. You will lose your life if you do not worship and bow down before me. And he's actually carrying out the pronunciation, carrying out the death sentence, pronouncing it on those who will not worship and bow down before it. Awesome power. Awesome demonic satanic wonder here. Now, if we're talking about the figurative picture, see, this is where, again, you're stretching it a little bit, I think. But what you could say is that if the figurative is in view, then that spiritual idol within them, that image within them, it's a spirit of Antichrist within them. And it is telling the people that it is within, this image is within them, it's telling them to kill everyone that does not worship the beast. Everyone that does not set up the idol in their own heart. And so what they do, the world cooperates en masse with the beast, and it results in the mass martyrdom of the saints. And this image is speaking within them, telling them, and goading them, and it's a demonic type thing, maybe demons themselves, speaking to their hearts, telling them that they must now go out and kill everyone, see, that will not worship the beast. However, I feel personally that the literal is a little bit stronger than the figurative. I feel like you start stretching it a little bit if you make it all figurative. Verse 16. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. Well, we're getting into the terrain that the speculationists love, and there's been a lot that has been said about the following verses. But the point here in verse 16 is that all classes of people on the earth are going to worship the beast, except for the Laodiceans now. And they are going to receive a mark either in their right hand or in their forehead. We don't know exactly what that mark is. But there's going to be some type of mark given to them that's going to mark them or brand them as belonging to the Antichrist. Notice the categories, the small and the great, referring to status and age. Whether their status is that of being a great one in society, or old in age, or young in age, or whatever, small and great now, they receive the mark. Rich and poor, alluding to their possessions, it doesn't matter. Money's not going to save your skin during this hour. You're going to have to take the mark whether your name is Rockefeller or not. And then free and bond, referring to their state in society, regardless of their social standing now, everyone receives the mark. Now, the word mark is the Greek word karagma. Karagma. Karagma, which is spelled C-H-A-R-A-G-M-A. What it means is a stamp, or it has the idea of an etching, or it has the idea of a brand, like you're branding someone, or an engraving, or a tattoo, or a print. So any of those type of ideas. They're going to receive a print, or a brand, or an etching, or an engraving on them. And you see, it was very common during Paul's day and John's day and the day of Jesus to brand a common slave with a special mark of the owner. And they would literally physically brand them. And they were branded with their owner's name. And now that name was branded on you just like you do with an old cow or anything like that. And when you saw that person, you knew that they belonged to someone else. Just like the Brahmins in India, they have a special mark upon their foreheads, especially the women, a little red mark on their forehead. And that brands them as far as marking them as belonging to their God. The word karagma occurs in the following verses in the book of Revelation. It occurs here in this verse, verse 16. It occurs down in verse 17, and all over in chapter 14 and verse 9 again. Chapter 14 and verse 11, it occurs. Also, chapter 15 and verse 2, it occurs. Chapter 16 and verse 2, chapter 19 and verse 20, and chapter 20 and verse 4. Now, what the Bible calls this here, and it doesn't say it right here in this verse, but over in chapter 16, it calls it the mark of the beast. That's why we've been calling it that. It calls it the mark of the beast. Now, you'll notice if you read your Bibles carefully that in verse 11 and in verse 12 and in verse 13 and in verse 14 and verse 15, and in other words, all the preceding verses up to verse 11, the subject of those verses has been the false prophet. And now a pronoun is used, he, and it would seem like in verse 16 that the false prophet is in view as well here. When it says that he causes all to take the mark, it would appear like this is the false prophet. Now, beast is mentioned at the end of verse 15, but as the object of the preposition and not as the subject of the sentence. So it would appear that it is the false prophet here that's actually causing the world to take the mark of the beast. And undoubtedly, if the false prophet is doing this, the world church is going to be involved in this as well. That, you know, it's too much for one man to go around and carry this all out. That the world church, his agents, those that are involved in it, will probably be the dupes of the world government as well. And so here again, picture the world church leader intertwined with the world government, and this mark, as it were, brands men as property of the beast system. Now, just like we talked about the preceding verses, two possibilities here about the nature of this mark. Is it literal or is it figurative? Well, you can guess which way I lean. I feel like it, again, is probably literal. If you read through all the following verses that I gave you, the Bible seems to make it real clear this is a real tangible, real noticeable type thing. Either you've got it or you don't. They examine you, and you either have the mark, and if you don't, off with your head, as it were, but if you do, then you're accepted. And it seems like it's something more than just a nebulous, yes, I have a figurative mark on me or whatever. It seems like it is a real, tangible thing. Now, if it's a literal mark on the right hand or the forehead, it could be either visible at all times, and as you were walking around there, here's this number right on your forehead, or this mark right on your forehead, or on your right hand, see? And it could be visible at all times. Or it's possible with their technology today to make it visible only under special light, where it is not necessarily visible at all times. In fact, one source I've read, and many sources agree with this, that IBM has the technology, in fact, they're actually using it now, they developed what are called laser tattoo guns. And with these laser tattoo guns, they're actually able to give individuals tattoos that are invisible to the naked eye. And under infrared light and so forth, the image then appears under certain types of lights. And it's painless when you receive it. And they use it for marking like fish and everything. They have fish coming down through the channels, and they use this laser gun to brand them and so forth, one after another. So it's something that would be quick, it would be efficient. But the point is that no one can buy or sell and therefore live without this mark. So it could be something like you go into a business place and they've got a scanner or they've got a special light and they're checking if you've got that mark. And so therefore, all the financial system of the world is now under the control of the beast. And you either have the mark or you can't carry out transactions. And if you don't have the mark, you can't buy. You can't go to anyone and buy anything unless you've got that mark. J.F. Walvoord in his commentary says about this mark, page 209, quote, "There is no need for a complicated explanation. The mark is simply a token that they are beast worshippers. And it serves as an identification necessary to conduct business and to purchase the necessities of life. It is another device to force all people to worship the beast," end quote. So it might be something very simple. You take the mark, whatever it might be, and therefore you can now buy. And it's going to be an identification type mark. Now, what does that mean if you don't have the mark? If you don't have the mark, you're labeled as a traitor. You're a traitor to the world government now. And everyone that does not have the mark will be undoubtedly either killed instantly or else starve to death slowly and just be banished from being able to buy anything or sell anything. And you're just excommunicated now, as it were, from this world society. There's no such thing as freedom here. It's a totalitarian-type world government. Now, furthermore, and you notice now I'm doing a bit of speculating now. I'm not telling you exactly what it is, but the mark possibly could be individualized, where you have like your own identification number. There could be various digits, various symbols that would give the code for your name and your account or your finances or whatever. You know, they could take like your social security number and add a couple of key numbers to it. They could say like 5016 526 58536. 666 is there, but then there are the individualized numbers there as well, which mark your account as separate from anyone else. Something like that could happen, in which you have your own bank account, you have your own ID, you have your own automatic fund transfer. There's a cashless society, in a sense, in the world. Something like that. Or it could just simply be the same mark for everyone. And everyone's got this mark. It does not vary. It's simply a sign of worship and homage. It's a sign of allegiance to the last day world government. Either you've got that mark, you know, it could be like the peace symbol or whatever, you know, whatever it would be. But either you have the mark or you don't, and so forth. Now, how about the figurative mark? Yeah, how about it? Tomorrow, yes. Well, you read those verses, and you see if you can't figure out what they're talking about there, the mark of the beast.